Hey everyone, it's Jason Hyland from the Sub 70 podcast. The guest we had this week is Vince India, web.com tour player, got his card to be out there in 2019 just through Q School a couple weeks ago. It's great stuff. Really enjoyed the interview. He's a Chicago guy, so of course we have to root for him. He's a really great follow on social media as well. On Twitter especially, he's at VINDIA36, the at symbol in front of it. Check him out. And I hope you enjoy the podcast with Vince. Loved having him on, and it'll be fun to see what he accomplishes in 2019. Give us any feedback or rating on the podcast, and thank you so much for listening. And without further ado, here's Vince.
This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, it takes a hop shank off the path.
You gotta be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Well, I would like to welcome to the Sub 70 podcast former All-American at the University of Iowa, the 2018 Illinois Open champion, and the 2019 tour graduate to play on the web.com tour next year, Vince India. Vince, appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
First off, congratulations, shooting 2300 at Q School. Very impressive, and getting status, you know, in 2019 on the web.com tour. Some great playing. What part of your game really sort of hit on all eight cylinders that week? And obviously you must have been doing a lot of things well, not just one, but sort of all came together, I suppose.
Right. I drove it really well last week. And there's just enough trouble out there. It's desert golf, so like you get to miss it on both sides a little bit. But there's a few holes where in the back of your mind, the desert just kind of sneaks in a little bit more than you should. And to take care of the par five out there, you need to carry some cross bunkers and thread a needle here and there. And I hit my lines really well all week, so that allowed me to have some really short numbers in the par fours and almost hit every par five and two, which I'm not sure a whole lot of people could say.
I saw some, you know, conversations on Twitter that the golf course must be super easy. I don't know the course personally that well. Was the golf course that easy, or were the guys playing that well and the conditions fairly benign? And you give those kind of benign conditions to players of your caliber, there's going to be low scores.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. The golf course is easy, but also the skill level of the players playing they're all really exceptional golfers. There's already like four or five guys I could just kind of tell that are going to be on the PGA Tour next year, and they should probably be on the PGA Tour right now, except there's just no way for them to get there. But certainly the golf courses were easy. We were playing in a dome. I couldn't remember having more than like 2 or 3 to 4 mile an hour winds all week. So flags were pretty limp, and the greens were fairly good. So it was just bash it down the fairway and then wedge it close. And then it came down to a putting contest in the end.
Yeah, and I was just going to get to that. You said you drove it well, but obviously to shoot 23 under par in four rounds, the putter, you must have been seeing your lines really well. It must have, the cup had to look pretty big, I have to imagine, to make that many of them.
Yeah, the cup did look big. There was the greens on the one golf course, Devil's Claw, they were really subtle. It's almost like you had a fine break at times, so having played it a year or two ago, I knew the subtleties of the greens just enough that where if I was indecisive about something, I just put it inside the hole because I knew the greens didn't break a whole lot. But I have been working on my putting a lot more than I have in recent years because I know it's something that I need to advance to get to the next level. So I was reading the greens well, but then I also was hitting my lines more often than I have in the past. So that's kind of nice to see how that work pay off.
Yeah, it's not a bad combination when you're driving it long and straight and putts are going in. That usually will get the job done. At 12th, right? I mean, that's what you guys are. That's I mean,
that's our job.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's the game, right? Hit it out there far and make some putts. 12th position. So how many starts does that guarantee you? And then for the listeners, how does that reshuffle sort of work on the web.com? And where will you have to reevaluate based on your starts early in the year? Or are you exempt the whole year being top 12? Or, I'm sorry, at 12th place in Q school, I should say.
Right. I'll get 8 starts. I forgot they changed up how many exemptions they gave out this year. It was down from top 45 to top 40 getting full status. So in the years past, it was 2 through 15th place get 12 starts. So people had to tell me I was getting an A. I was like, oh, that's, well, that's all right. 8's plenty because that gets me through the first 8 tournaments. And you don't have to make a whole lot of money to keep advancing several thousand dollars. And then I'll be subject to a reshuffle after the 8th event. But the way I'm playing right now, I'll be playing the entire year because my golf game is so much better than what it was last year that I'll be making, hopefully, at least 5 figures by the first few events.
What tournament will you start off your 2019 season in? Will you go down to the Bahamas? Or are you going to wait a little bit? Or are you going to start off out of the gate?
Yeah, the cool thing about this schedule is I think all the hard golf courses, they're all front-loaded. Like, the 2 Bahamas courses, they're difficult. There's a fair bit of water on both sides. If the conditions get crappy, I think that eliminates a lot of players as well. And then Colombia and Panama. Colombia is short and tight, but it's usually firm, and it's just tricky enough that the scores aren't very low. And then Panama's probably one of the hardest golf courses we play all year. And then I heard that new Florida golf course is exceptional as well. So I will start out from the beginning in the Bahamas and play the first 5 weeks, just because I'm kind of ready to go. Yeah, I'm going through some time off right now, which is nice, a little bit of decompression from tournament golf and trying to see some friends and family for the holidays, and then I'll be ready to go once the new year comes around.
So with the lovely winter weather we get in Chicagoland, and for the listeners, Vince, you've lived in Chicago, grew up here kind of most of your life too. What part of, or how much before the season starts do you need to get out of here and go somewhere warm and kind of work on your game and get out of these conditions? And what part of the country are you going to be heading to sort of get that practice in that you need to be sharp?
I have plans to go down to Jacksonville for about 7 or 8 days before I head to the Bahamas, and which is fine. That's plenty of time. Like, I figured out that it takes me about 6 to 7 days to fully understand where the ball is going once I get out and get playing again. But as long as I'm doing stuff indoors here and working out regularly, I'm not going to lose a lot of my feels from the golf course. So I'm lucky enough to be able to practice at Northwestern in the wintertime, and a few other facilities around the Chicago area let me come in and get some work in. So that's kind of my timetable. I'll ship out just after the new year and get some work done in Jacksonville with some of the guys there.
What do you do with your caddy situation for 2019? So you're guaranteed, you know, the 8 starts. Let's assume it turns into a full season. Do you hire someone temporarily? Do you take a local caddy who knows that golf course? I've seen that golf course in the Bahamas could get really tricky. Like, if you don't have a full season lined up, how do you kind of approach, you know, the caddy situation?
Yeah, it's tough. It's really hard to find good help on the web.com, honestly. Like, a lot of the guys have just circled between players, and which is good because they've seen the golf course and, you know, they know what to expect from certain places. But I've kind of lucked out. I'm going to have a friend come down who lives in Miami, and which is convenient because it's a plane, one plane ride away from the Bahamas, Colombia, and Panama. So he'll be there with me for the first couple events. And he's someone I've known for a long time. We've played on Latin America for a while. And he was more than willing to come down and help me for the first couple of weeks. So after that, I'm not sure. He's still playing, so I don't think he's going to be like a full-time gig, but I will certainly be looking for someone full-time once we start getting into the States.
Any equipment changes for 2019? And if you have switched equipment, how long and does that process take for you to put something in the bag that you're comfortable with?
As of right now, I don't see myself changing anything. I think the days of really awesome club contracts are slowly coming to an end. I'm talking to more and more players, and it seems like more guys are leaning toward mixing and matching clubs from different companies in their bags, and that's certainly what I've done the last year. So I'm really happy with where things are with my woods, my irons, wedges, and putter. The only thing I could probably switch out are the irons. Those seem to be the easiest to change in between seasons, but currently no plans to.
Yeah, it's interesting you were saying that. I was reading that even like Ryan Palmer is just going to go this year completely on his own. Even a tour veteran like that can make, he said it's just not worth it because he doesn't want to potentially have a 14-club deal where he has to play all those clubs. He'd rather pick and choose what he wants. It's interesting since Nike's left the arena in hard goods of how that market sort of changed.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like I always thought the market was inflated for club contracts, and it seems like the bubble has completely burst or is in the process of bursting right now. I saw in the last couple of years that just general ball shoe glove contracts are down, and the willingness to sign even players who have conditional status has decreased over the years. So it's a good time to go out and then do what you want, honestly, because I played some really good golf with a mixed bag right now, and I love the way everything is kind of feeling in my setup.
Will you still have a bag and hat deal for 2019?
A bag deal? No. What I have lined up so far is ball shoe gloves from Titleist, Odyssey putter deal. And that's about it. I'm not required to wear a hat by anybody. If anything, I might wear my clothing supplier, Holderness and Born. They're making some really quality stuff. And I believe their hats are made by Imperial. So
yep, good stuff.
Yeah, awesome stuff. If you've never heard of Holderness and Born, it's kind of a cool story. Two guys from the Wall Street, good golf buddies, decided they didn't like the way their clothes were fitting. And with like a little bit of a golf background, they decided to start their own company. And now like you can't even keep it in stock on Chicago golf shelves in the country clubs. Like it's flying off the shelves of Bobolink, off Beverly. Real cool looking stuff. It's like a hybrid between Peter Millar and like the RLX line from Polo. It's a lot of pastel colors. You'd find it on pretty popular with like the Lake Forest crowd or like the North Shore crowd. So it's good looking stuff. It's right up my alley.
Yeah, and a cool brand to be associated with, right? Good looking stuff and a good story behind it.
Yeah, totally grassroots. I love it.
So let's talk about the web. This is, you've got some experience out there. Played the web before. You sound obviously really confident about your game, and you should have good reason to. I mean, you played well at Q School. Do you kind of feel this year you're sort of ready to consistently take it to that next level?
Yeah, I know. Like the biggest part for me was I had a really good grasp of where my golf game was 2 years ago. Then I hurt myself, and it's been like a really long and unanticipated road to get back to where I know where the golf club is consistently and I know where the ball's going. But now I'm kind of back even past where I was in 2016. So I have a better understanding of my body and like how it responds to certain things, certain situations. And I certainly know how I need to address my weaknesses to get to the PGA Tour, which is the big part. I know what I need to do, and I know what I need to do or how to get better.
I was kind of doing the research for this, the podcast. and you've even kind of made comments on Twitter about it, but the record you have at getting through Q school, I don't think people realize like how hard that actually is. And, you know, it's to keep doing it and getting through. How many years have you made it through Q school from stage one, you know, past stage two to stage three? Is it 4 or 5 years in a row at this point?
6 years in a row.
And then, yeah, as a follow-up to that, I mean, that's real pressure, right? You're kind of playing for your livelihood. Does that situation ever get comfortable, or does the pressure just not seem – can you just put it aside and say it's just playing rounds of golf? Like, how do you keep dealing with what some people call, like, the biggest pressure cooker ever, Q school, and keep finding the fortitude to get through it like you've been doing, especially injured?
Yeah, I don't know if there's any rhyme or reason to it. Like, I have a very good way of putting a positive spin on everything. And it's not like I'm telling myself, oh, well, everything's going to be okay, you know, no worries if you don't get it through. But, like, I just, when I get on a golf course, I kind of just take everything in stride. Like, you know, I have a well-thought-out game plan, that's for sure. Like, I think that's the most important part of that. I have a very individualized plan to attack every hole and how to maximize my birdie percentage. So that eliminates unnecessary risks. And I think, the other way that, you kind of address getting through Q school is that, you almost have to make light of the situation. Like you have to convince yourself that it's not a big deal. And that's just, hey, it's another round of golf. Let's go play golf. Let's get the ball in the hole. Let's go make twos and threes and fours. No fives, no sixes, no three putts. And then that'll usually just take care of itself. So that's kind of my philosophy. And a part of that is also I have routines. Like during Q school, obviously it's a little bit more stressful situation than most. I get 3 drinks a night during Q school. Just, you know, to kind of take a little bit off the edge, and it calms the mind just a little bit toward the end of the day, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, you must have some program that's working, because, like I said, that's playing under some pressure. It's playing under some serious pressure and getting through it.
Yeah, so that's kind of how I dumb down the pressure of Q school. It's I just kind of have a way of not making it a big deal if that's the way. I'm not sure. Don't get me wrong, I get nervous. Like, I maybe the most nervous I've been, well, certainly within the last couple of months, was the last round of Q school this week. Yeah, there's just a way, like, you just have to believe in yourself. Like, the reason why you're playing good golf the reason why you're at Q school right now is because you're playing good golf. So there's no reason for you to ever play bad, since, you know, what got you here is your skills, and you have to believe in your skills. So go out and hit the golf shots. You've done it 1,000 times. Just keep on doing what you know how to do, really.
Kind of talking about that same scenario, you won the 2018 Illinois Open, and just, you know, does winning, I'm probably answering my own question, but winning breeds winning, right? Winning breeds confidence.
Right.
That has to be, you know, you come off an injury, you go out and win that. That has to set the tone for late summer and the rest of the sort of that year of the confidence that you have, right? Like you can win at a pretty high level. You've done it yet. And that's got to be a great way to carry into stage one, stage two, and kind of keep that momentum going, right? Like winning is winning.
Right. Absolutely. What I thought was really cool about that is the Illinois Open is that I had a pretty average first round. Actually, it's more so mediocre than average. And, I didn't really freak myself out. Like I probably was 5 or 6 shots back of the lead. I couldn't even remember what it was, but I kind of told myself, well, all right, so we have 2 rounds left here. What would be the 36-hole lead at a web.com event? And I was like, okay, that's maybe 16 under at the Glen Club, maybe 15 under. So I kind of went out there with an attitude saying that, you know what, we're going to get to 16 under, and it doesn't matter how we're going to do it. We're just going to go out and get there. And that's, that was the first time where I wasn't afraid of going like 9 or 10 under in a round. And then like I've noticed throughout the end of the fall, it's been easier for me to get past like 4 and 5 under in a tournament round. So I thought that is something I took out of the Illinois Open more than per se winning, is that like lifting the cloud once you're 4 to 5 under par, let's get to like 7, 8, and 9 under, and I keep pushing birdies. Do you know what I mean?
Actually, I don't, because if I'm around like 1 under, I'm like ecstatic as a 1 handicap. So no, I'm not familiar with that level of play at a 1 iota. My, you know, your 7 under is like my even par, where it's like, okay, let's try to get to 1 or 2 under. But I get what you're saying. And my follow up to that would be, when you're in that sort of a zone, when you're at 9 or 10 under par, do you know you're playing well, but do you even know that you're that far under, or is it just sort of, you're just in this zone and you're seeing the shots and you're not thinking about it. You're just getting the ball in the hole. Like, where is your mind when you're that far under par and it's working that way?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Like, you see the shots and then your body just instinctually goes and hits them. It's a very cool feeling. I felt it. There was a Pepsi Tour event the first week I was down in Arizona, the week before Q School, and I shot 9 under in the opening round. And it was just one of those things where, like, I walked off the 18th green and I forgot what I shot because I was too busy trying to birdie every hole and just seeing shots and then, like, instinctually hitting golf shots. It was probably the most closely related thing to athletics as I've ever done in my life. Like, you just kind of see the shot and you hit the shot. There's no thinking, there's no talking. It's just, you see it and then you go hit it. That's more or less what I describe the zone as.
So let's say this quality play continues into 2019, and I don't know how you put your goals down, but what would make 2019 on the web.com tour a successful year? Is it maintaining the card? Is it getting a win? Is it, you know, top 25 to get to the PGA Tour? Do you sort of evaluate it from the whole year, or do you kind of maybe do it in quarters or something like that, of like, okay, you know, I'm going to be playing more than 8, let's go from there? How do you sort of put that on paper so you can sort of aim to hit those goals or the expectations that you have for yourself?
I would definitely love an early top 10 just to kind of settle in there, and then I could, at that point, I can take advantage of Wednesday pro-ams and start adjusting my routines. Like, I would get to tournaments later because I'll be allowed to play on Wednesday. So the idea is to play well early in the year, adjust the schedule so I don't have to do as much work on Monday, Tuesday, and which would obviously help the way I kind of recover from tournament to tournament. And then I think a good goal for the end of the year is the top 50 on the money list. And if I keep working on the things I've been working on and listen and pay attention to my body, and when it's not feeling good or when it's feeling fine, I think a top 25 on my list is certainly doable.
I was looking at your stats last year on when you did play the web. Driver distance was pretty good. You know, it was 310 yards, and it's a pretty good pop. And you're not 6'4" and 220 pounds. So, you know, golf has turned into a power game. You're not, you know, huge like Dustin Johnson or something that size, but you generate a lot of clubhead speed. So not being, you know, naturally 6'3" or 6'4", how do you keep your body in shape, and what are you doing to generate that sort of clubhead speed consistently, you know, in your late 20s and as you're getting into your 30s? And I'm assuming it's something that's important, because if you look at the stats, distance is a huge key to success. And it's, you know, when I was on the web.com tour this year watching the guys play, I mean, they absolutely kill it, you know, on the tour.
So far, it's crazy. Yeah.
So how are you competing against guys who naturally would have an advantage, you know, just from arc and size, to kind of keep up with them?
You know, I certainly, when I was younger, I did it through like inefficiencies of a golf swing. Like you said, I'm not the biggest person in the world, so I would end up having like to throw my entire body at the golf ball to kind of hit it far when I was younger. But now I'm filling out slowly but surely. I'm allowed to swing with the same aggressiveness, but have a little bit more stability in my golf swing. So, I don't know. I've always kind of been able to create speed. It's something that's never been taught to me before. I just figured out that, you know, you probably got to start using the ground pretty good to create speed. Like, no one showed me how to use the ground. It's kind of just something I figured out on my own. And, you could say it causes back problems, but I'm not going to go say that. But as long as I keep working in the gym, and the whole goal is being able to support this speed now with my frame. So that's kind of the goal going forward.
Being like you're back on the web.com again, I'm assuming you've seen many of these golf courses, and sort of looking at it from 10,000 feet, is there a real advantage in this is not your first go around and you have seen those courses? And is there a number you think you could even kind of put up there that this might save you one or two strokes, you know, a week because you've played that tournament, you know, that break, you've seen it versus the guys out there who are just going to be doing it and you've done it. Is there an inherent advantage of your experience that you currently have?
Well, not necessarily like knowing breaks on the golf course. They're not going to put the pins in the same locations every year. Most of them, yes, but I'm not sure I can really remember certain golf courses, the nuances of every green. But I think the thing I was very bad at when I first got out on tour is like having a routine about my week where I was fully charged and I had a lot left in the tank on Sunday. It could be a product of getting older too, but I've almost adjusted my routines where I do less toward the beginning of the week, like the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of practice rounds. Since I've seen these golf courses too, that allows me to do less, and then that allows me to have more energy and more in the tank coming down the stretch on the weekend, which is super helpful because the golf courses we go play are in the middle of like Springfield, Missouri. And we have four tournaments in Tennessee during the middle of summer. So it gets hot out there, and anything extra you can have on the weekend is going to help you because it's really mentally fatiguing when it's so hot in some of the places we play.
You kind of got into my next question. I know the web.com goes to a lot of mid-sized markets. And my question is, with all the traveling you've done, is there any mid-sized markets that you were like, this city is absolutely awesome, I did not think it would be that cool, and it was a great spot to play golf and hang out in?
Yeah, Boise for sure, 100%. That's a cool little town in general. I didn't know what to expect from Boise, but it's a very cool desert mountain, not necessarily desert mountain, but a high desert town, college campus, not really nice people. The community really gets behind it. I didn't play the Savannah golf tournament last year, but everyone was saying that's going to become one of the best golf tournaments on the web.com tour in the next couple of years. So that's a very awesome market for it. I've always wondered why Florida didn't have the support it needed, and it's really cool to see the tour go to Lakewood Ranch, which is where I lived there for 4 years right out of college. So I can imagine that it'll be supported very well by the community, and there should be a fair amount of people out there. I think it's besides the PGA Tour event at Innisbrook, I'm not sure there's another golf tournament on the west coast of Florida. Let's see, besides that, Wichita throws a great party. That's a really fun tournament. I'd say those three or four really stand out.
When you started playing golf, who introduced you to the game, and in what age did you sort of start to fall in love with it?
My father did when I was 9 or 10. And I tell everybody it's a function of me not being physically able to play like football or basketball, because I was like just a scrawny looking choir boy. Like this kid's not going to do anything underneath the hoop. He's just going to throw up threes from half court and maybe make 1 out of 10. And then I was virtually useless on a football field. So I never dabbled in that. I was fairly mediocre at soccer. And that's about my entire athletic career when I was growing up. So my dad's like, let's try this. Maybe you can prove yourself worthy as a son.
Was your dad a good golfer?
He's okay. I mean, he's certainly competitive. Like, he's been about a 12 to 18 handicap his entire life. Yeah, still loves it, still likes the game, still likes to get better in practice. So he was good. He created a really friendly environment for me to take up golf, and obviously supported my career, even as a junior golfer.
How did the scholarship at Iowa come about? Was there other colleges in the mix, and how did you wind up, you know, playing golf out there, and how was that experience overall?
Yeah, it was a total accident. I wanted to play golf for Illinois or Michigan State, and when Illinois didn't recruit me, which is fine, they recruited two players, which were much better than I were. I'll admit that. It was down to, like, Notre Dame and Michigan State, and then there was a mix-up in conversation between those two coaches, and they both mutually thought I was committed to one another. And then all of a sudden, I wasn't signed in the fall period, and there ensued a lot of panic. And then, luckily, the head coach from Iowa stepped down, and the intern coach reached out to out-of-state players for once, and he offered me a little bit of a scholarship. So at that point, I said, absolutely, I'll play for anyone. And ironically, the coach from Michigan State, Mark Hankins, came over, and he was one of the guys I wanted to play for, and he coached me for 4 years, and it worked out better than I could have ever imagined.
At what point did you know your game was good enough that you were going to try, you know, to turn pro and take it to that next step? Was it junior or senior, or did you know at a pretty young, you know, age playing collegiate golf that you were going to at least give this a whirl?
It was probably somewhere after my junior year going into senior year. Like, I started just really, I took it seriously like a job at that point. Like, in previous years I would caddy, or like I find like a part-time job during the summer, but I treated golf like a job the summer going into my senior year of college, and it paid dividends. Like, I won the state amateur, I qualified for the U.S. amateur, had some other really good showings in amateur tournaments throughout the year, and then I carried that success in my senior year and played phenomenally, I thought. And it was kind of always in the back of my head. Like, I wasn't, like, itching to turn pro, but I'm like, oh, there's probably a reasonable chance I could give this a shot. And after I graduated, Callaway approached me because I had a decent relationship with them for a couple of years. And they were willing to take me underneath their wing and support me for my first couple of years. So I owe a lot to them. I didn't have them behind me for my first couple of years, I don't think I'd be where I am right now.
And then what tours did you play when you first turned pro? And is there any, when I do the podcast, there always seems to be some classic stories of strange travel, or, you know, playing the mini tours on a shoestring budget with four guys in a bad car. Like, there's always these sort of war stories that sort of, you know, they look back and smile upon those stories. So is there any, what tours did you play? Mm-hmm. And is there any, oh my gods, I can't believe we, you know, got through that gauntlet, per se?
Yeah. The first year or two, I played like the Hooters tour off and on because I didn't know what else there was to do. And then I was introduced to a friend at a Hooters tour event who said he was going to do Latino America qualifying, PGA Tour Latino America. And that was my first real tour. I was a part of that had like a big kind of feel to it. And I played a full year out there in 2013. And I'll say this, it's one of those tours that you could be totally okay with missing a cut because you're in a very interesting part of the country, or part of the world. For me, at least, I thought it was fascinating that we were traveling to other places and experiencing other cultures and people that, you know, if I miss a cut, that's totally fine. I'm going to go explore the city and see what people are doing and see how they live their lives. And, let's just take a little excerpt from about 3 months ago in Brazil. There's two back-to-back tournaments in Sao Paulo. The first tournament is in the city, and the tour schedules a bus to go out to the country where the second tournament is on Sunday evening after play is completed. So the bus is scheduled to leave about 6:30, which gave us all a chance to watch our beloved football, which we haven't watched in like a week or so since they don't stream football down in Brazil very frequently. So we're all in the clubhouse drinking beers. One of the guys made a hole-in-one that day, so there's plenty to go around. And we brought it all on the bus, and ended up getting pretty rowdy on the bus. So the two-hour travel time up into the suburbs of Sao Paulo flew by pretty quickly. Got there about more or less 9:30 or 10, got some grub, and we were all kind of winding down, figuring out what we were going to do. And one of my buddies from Chile comes around and goes, "Hey, boys, around the corner, I found a great nightclub. You want to come check it out with me?" And I go, "It's Horatio. It's a Sunday. Like, what could they possibly be doing on a Sunday in Brazil?" And lo and behold, this club was open till 4 a.m. on a Sunday. And I had to drag myself out by my own pants before it hit 4 a.m. Otherwise, I would have been in no shape to do anything that week. So that's just kind of what can happen on Latino America. It's one of my favorite tours out to play on, and it never gets old, honestly. It's such a fun time for me to travel in other places and experience other cultures.
Well, also, I think it's fairly cool that around Chicagoland roots, we've kind of got this group of guys in their 20s who are like playing some pretty good golf, and the potentials are to play some great golf, you know, with Doug Gim and TK Kelly, Nick Hardy. Are you close to those guys? Do you ever play, you know, do you guys play some competitive matches, and do you guys kind of feed off each other? Meaning, like, you know, if, you know, Doug's going to be out on the web with you guys, like, is there some fun competitiveness between you guys all from Chicago as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I've probably known Nick and Doug longer than most people have known them. When I was 23, the Merritt Club up in Libertyville had like a junior golf program. And Nick was a part of that program when I was there too. Even though I was there for 1 year, he continued to be there long after I left. But I started playing golf with Nick when he was in, man, maybe like a sophomore in high school or something, maybe a freshman. So I got to see him when he was a lot younger, and I knew he had a whole lot of game. But I've been playing golf with Doug Gimp on and off for the last 5 or 6 years. I've known Doug since he was like a junior in college, and we've played dozens of rounds together in the summertime. We share mutual friends up in the Chicago suburbs, and you know, I've got to watch this golf game grow, and I like to tease him and say, I taught him everything he knows. So he's a good friend of mine, and it was kind of cool that we were paired up the last two rounds of Q School as well. So I think it's good. I think Chicago golf's in a really cool spot right now with all the young talent around here. I mean, David Cook has his European Tour card. Doug and I both have web.com cards, and Brian Billington, TK Kelly, Nick Hardy, they're all exceptional players. They'll be just fine. I'm not going to really worry about them. Brad Hoffinger too. How could you forget my former teammate? And he's got a web.com card too. So, yeah, we're in a pretty good spot, honestly.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch, right? Like, Chicago just roots for their hometown guys. Like, and it's, I don't remember the last, I mean, the talent pool's pretty deep. It's going to be fun to watch. It really is. Like, I'm excited to see how all the guys are doing, you know, a year or two from now. I think there's a lot of potential there. So
I agree.
It's going to be interesting. Well, the next ones I have are just sort of quick hitters, and we'll get you out of here. So I ask you a few questions and whatever comes to your mind on this one. So two or three favorite golf courses, let's just say in the Midwest area, and then what's your home course that you play out of in Chicagoland when you're home?
I would probably say Shore Acres and Inverness in Toledo. Those are I've never played Chicago golf, but Shore Acres is my number one in Chicago. And right behind that, though, is Old Elm and Beverly. Those are my top three in Chicago. Inverness in Toledo is exceptional. They just redid the golf course. They restored it to some Donald Ross architectural plans, and it is going to host some major tournaments coming down the road here. It is big time. And I play most of my golf at Kemper Lakes up in Kildare. Really good golf course. Probably one of the hardest golf courses in Illinois, in my opinion. But besides that, I go out to Conway every now and then, Beverly, Westmoreland. The pros are really gracious to me, so I can't thank them enough for helping me out and with my situation.
I'm with you on Shore Acres. After they took some of those trees out, if people ever get a chance to play it, I think it's Chicago golf and that to me are, and I think Old Elm too. I was going to ask you, how do you like Old Elm after they removed a bunch of the trees out of there?
You know, I never played it before all the trees were removed, but I still think they could probably remove some more trees. Before I was a real big fan of like the architectural process and like the golden age and the history of golf architecture, like I thought Medina was like the coolest golf course in the world, because all you saw was like the oak trees forever. And the more I think about it, that like, you know, trees are just, they're not even obstacles. They're just kind of a nuisance in most cases. So Shore Acres does it perfectly. And of course, I've never been to Chicago golf. They probably have like four trees on the property.
Yeah, there's no trees. But there's really no trees in play. You'd have to hit a horrendous golf shot to have a tree in play out there.
Yeah, but in my opinion, trees are more for framing golf holes and to provide depth. And Shore Acres does that perfectly. They'll have clusters of oak trees in the distance, and that way you can kind of like it frames holes and provides a background. There's one or two that actually come into play, specifically that 10th hole, that enormous oak on the left side there. That's a good tree. Like that tree belongs there, because you know that's clearly the bailout, because there's OB right. But you can't bail out left because you're underneath the biggest oak tree on the property. So that's kind of my whole philosophy right there.
And I think they said that, I don't know how long ago you played it. I played it years ago, and it was overgrown with trees compared to the, you know, original, you know, Seth Rayner architecture. And since they brought that out, it was great with the trees. It is just superb at this point. So I think we have the same tastes in golf clubs, and you got to get out to Chicago to play sometime. If you love Old Elm and you love Shore Acres, you got to go see that one too. It's so good.
I thought Old Elm was very cool, but I think the greens might be too fast there. Like we played on a very cold and wet day when it was like misting and raining at times, and these greens are still like 13s. I talked to the guys in the pro shop. They're like, oh yeah, they're kind of slow today. And I went on the putting green. I just still couldn't believe how fast they were rolling. And it's almost like I developed like this pseudo yips out there. Like the greens were so fast, I didn't know what to do with my hands. Like how hard are you putts when like you're putting on a basketball court? You know what I mean?
Get above the hole and just hit the classic toe putt, right? Where you just barely toe it and pray to God it stopped. If you get above some of those holes, like on 18 or something like that, oh my gosh, those things are just, if you get out of position there, you can three putt or four. I mean, so easy.
It was like one of the genuine first times where like I was in like a non-competitive round, like a total casual round where like no one was gambling. I was playing with my trainer and two of his friends, and like I laid up on a pitch shot on a par five because I was so scared of hitting it over this one green and then just being completely screwed from the opposite side of the pin that I just kind of like, yeah, I'm just going to take my 15 footer and get out of here.
Well, if you ever got to Chicago, like in the fall when they're running, there's some severe slope, and they got to be 13 or 14 with slope out there too. And it just is terrifying. It's literally, you know, especially for us amateurs, like it's a terrifying speed. It's brilliant because the architecture is so good, but in the greens are so pure, but oh my gosh, it can put fear of God in you so quick.
So scary.
Next one I have, as we kind of get off on a tangent there, but it's interesting conversation of architecture. Do you play competitive golf on like Tuesdays to keep your game sharp? And if you do, you know, use that, you know, to gamble to kind of keep where it's not just a practice round, where it gets competitive. Is there any great stories you have of taking some guys for a few bucks?
Yes. I always believe it's worth anything to get your blood going a little bit. There's nothing worse than playing aimless golf out there. Aimless, mindless golf is, we might as well not even go out there and play in practice. So if there's anything I could feel on the golf course that was remotely close to during a tournament, I'm all for it. There was a situation a couple years ago, again, on the Latin American tour. We had a very consistent Tuesday game between myself and three friends. And I more or less funded this guy's career for like 6 months with how much he got out of my pocket for like 3 months of the year in practice rounds. It was unbelievable.
But you can't like, quit, right? You got to keep going at him.
No, so right. You know, I'm glad you're doing it because I feel like I'm sponsoring you at this point. I'm okay with you. It's better you taking my money than someone else digs, you know? So, yeah, it was well within, it was probably close to four figures at that point once a year ago, but hey, it was working.
Yeah, made you tougher, right? Look at the bright side.
Yeah, totally, something like that.
What golfer have you ever been around where you're just so impressed with their natural talent, where you were just, wow, that is so impressive, even for a golfer of your level, that they can just naturally do it?
Yeah, Tony Finau comes to mind for sure when I play with him. He just, yeah, he's kind of like a very freakishly athletic, unique human being. Hideki, when I played with him, he was far beyond my skill level when I played with him when we were both amateurs. First off, I've never heard of a guy, and all of a sudden he comes out and shoots 10 under. I was like, whoa, that was stinking flawless. Those two guys come to mind, I think.
And the last one I got for you, let's take Chicago Golf Club on off the list on this one, but is there a golf course on your wish list that you haven't played yet that you'd really love to play, or you can be one or two? So we'll take Chicago off of it, but is there any other ones that are on the hit list that you want to get out there and tee it up on?
Oh, boy. I would like to go out to Monterey Peninsula and check out, like, Pebble Beach, Cypress. Those golf courses in that area, then I would love to get to, like, the Long Island area and check out National Golf Lake, Shinnecock, Friar's Head. All those old historical golf clubs up there. So those are my bucket list of golf courses right there.
Yeah, that's not too bad of two areas. If you ever had to be stuck playing golf, there's worse things in life.
Yeah.
I can tell you. Well, thanks so much for being on. I'm really looking forward to seeing, you know, the 2019 campaign, and glad you're healthy, and like I said, great performance at Q School. So hopefully we can get you back on when you get that victory out there on the web, and best of luck next year.
Cool. Thanks for having me, Jason.